As a City National client, you get a dedicated team of banking professionals working alongside you. From a relationship manager who works with you on everyday business needs to a business banker who drives your goals into the future. Come in to meet your team at City National Bank. See what personal can do for you at cnb.com.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Monday, September 11th. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. The Pentagon has a plan to counter U.S. adversaries, including China, and it requires technology that is small, smart, and cheap. It would be a big change for the Defense Department, where bureaucracy typically means it takes a long time to develop and deploy cutting-edge tech. Our national security correspondent Nancy Youssef is going to join us to talk about the artificial intelligence systems that could protect U.S. interests across air, land, and sea. First, though, there are more signs that tech startups are struggling to raise money. According to Crunchbase, the median time between seed and Series A rounds, typically the point when a startup goes from being an idea to a fledgling business, has gotten longer this year, stretching to 25 months from 21 months last year. It's a sign that economic uncertainty, high interest rates, and a correction after the pandemic boom in tech investing are now biting early-stage startups. But our WSJ venture capital reporter Angus Lowton says it's unclear where things go from here.
We've been hearing all kinds of predictions in the past year that there's going to be a wave of down rounds, or there's going to be a wave of startup closings, or there's going to be this sudden surge in acquisitions to buy these lower priced startups. None of that has happened. Right now, things look a little sunnier than they did 6 months ago. The public tech market is doing much better than it was last year, certainly. That's good news for tech startups because now the conditions to list publicly are much better than they were. That moves the whole pipeline forward. But when that will happen is anybody's guess. Every time there's a good IPO, people like to jump on board and say, well, that's it. Now we're at the other end of this thing. Then what follows is another quarter or two of price corrections.
Expiration dates aren't something you typically think about with electronics, but they should be. And many schools are learning that lesson when it comes to cheap, easy-to-use Chromebooks they've purchased. An estimated 72% of Chromebooks are sold to educational institutions, according to analytics firm IDC. Many were purchased during the pandemic to support remote learning. And now, those laptops are hitting their use-by date. And that's creating a mounting pile of e-waste for schools and districts. Our personal tech columnist Nicole Nguyen joins us to discuss that. So Nicole, laptops expire?
Yes, all electronics eventually cease to receive software updates from their manufacturers. So if your Mac or PC is no longer supported by Windows or Apple, you'll stop getting software updates, but the browser applications, say Google Chrome, can continue updating for a while. So right now, a Mac as old as 14 years old can run the latest version of Chrome. Chromebooks are a little bit different. The browser and the operating system are tied together. So once that Chromebook reaches its expiration date, neither the operating system nor the browser can be updated. So eventually some websites will cease to work, such as Netflix. But for schools, it's even worse because online state testing, which is mandatory for a lot of these public schools, will not run on outdated machines.
You've been speaking with some schools who are finding themselves in this situation. Can you tell us a little bit about their experience?
Yeah, some schools are finding that they need to get approvals by school boards, and this approval process can be lengthy. And so they end up buying Chromebooks a year or two after their release date. And how Chromebook expiration dates work is that the clock starts ticking the minute it's available on shelves. And so if you're buying a Chromebook 1 or 2 years after its release date, then you have less of that amount of usable time for that Chromebook. Another issue is that Chromebooks don't have a resale value as scrap once they are outdated. One school administrator told me that she could easily sell bulk lots of Macs or PCs as scrap. And sometimes if she mixed Chromebooks in with those Macs or PCs, she could sell that lot. But Chromebook-only lots, nope, no one bid on them. And so she actually had to pay to haul away the Chromebooks as e-waste.
That's incredible, this electronic waste just kind of piling up for schools. What has Google said about this situation?
Google said that it's worked very hard to extend the lifespan of Chromebooks. I talked to a Chrome OS product manager who mentioned it's no trivial effort to extend the lifespan. So they have to test all of the supported models that they're going to push out new features to. And every 4 weeks, they release new updates. So every 4 weeks, they test on hundreds of machines times 8 years. You know, he said it's a lot of work for Google to do, but also they have to get manufacturers on board to make sure that they support their devices to run for the amount of time that they've guaranteed.
I mean, are there alternatives for schools rather than buying lots and lots of Chromebooks?
So Google has a software called Chrome OS Flex, and you can install it on Macs and PCs that are no longer supported. And that basically turns the operating system on those machines into a Chrome machine. So it works just like a Chromebook, even though the hardware is a Mac or a PC. And so this educator's dream is that there would be a pipeline of outdated Macs and PCs that could no longer be updated and no longer used by regular consumers, but could be used in a school context as Chromebooks.
That was our personal tech columnist, Nicole Nguyen. Coming up, the Pentagon wants to deploy an array of autonomous systems to keep pace with adversaries. But how does it plan to manage the time and cost needed to produce these? We'll discuss after the break.
As a Citi National client, you get a dedicated team of banking professionals working alongside you. From a relationship manager who works with you on everyday business needs to a business banker who drives your goals into the future. Come in to meet your team at Citi National Bank. See what personal can do for you at cnb.com.
The Pentagon is looking for ways to counter threats from China and other adversaries. And it's turning to a vast network of AI-powered technology, drones, and autonomous systems. Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks has provided new details about the department's plans to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to produce an array of air, land, and sea-based systems. Our correspondent Nancy Youssef is here to explain the Pentagon's plans. Nancy, Kathleen Hicks gave this address last Wednesday, and you spoke with her ahead of it. Can you tell us what she said?
Yeah, this is part of an initiative that she is leading in which the Pentagon would do a better job of removing some of the bureaucracy that stops companies that are providing smaller weapon systems, not the big ships and planes that we think about when we think of a Pentagon and military systems, but the unmanned drones, the satellites. These are systems that would be smaller, cheaper than what we traditionally think of as military systems, but also because of the technology are updated and change. And so the idea is that rather than going through traditional weapons purchase systems, that the Pentagon would find a way to get these systems into the warfighter's hands in 2 years. If it succeeds, you would see more traditional warfare systems coupled with sort of new types of technology in places like the Asia Pacific.
Can you tell us a little bit more about those technologies, and are they systems that the U.S. has ever used before?
What she described are, in some cases, are systems that we've already seen in the Middle East. For example, there's a group called Task Force 59, which was created in 2021, came about because the military was taking its ships and moving them away from the Middle East and towards the Asia Pacific, and so there was an admiral there who was trying to find ways to defend against threats from Iran without the sort of traditional capability. And so he worked with private sector companies to get drones and artificial intelligence across the sea in the Middle East region to get surveillance, to get eyes, to get a better understanding of what the Iranians were doing. Another scenario would be unmanned aircraft that would be operating or even operating in space. Some of the other ideas I've heard out of the Pentagon is, let's say a Marine serving in the Asia Pacific is injured, that Marine would get himself into a non-piloted plane that would get him to a ship where he would receive medical care.
You mentioned some of the technologies that the Pentagon is already implementing. So how far-fetched are some of the proposals that she was talking about?
It's a great question because we don't know how much of it is going to be new technology that we haven't seen before and how much of it is going to be taking things that have been applied in one part of the world, for example, Task Force 59 in the Middle East, and adapting it and expanding it into places like the Asia Pacific. What they've said is that they're going to reach out to each of the services, each of the combatant commanders, and ask them what their needs are and then go back to industry to kind of develop a list.
Do we know how much this is going to cost?
They've said that this will come out of existing budgets. She's put the number at hundreds of millions. But at the same time, she said that there'll be thousands of systems that'll come out of it. So the question is, can you fund the kinds of systems that we're talking about at that number? Remember, some of these systems, unmanned water-based drones, for example, can cost several million dollars each. And so because we don't know the systems, we don't know if that figure will actually hold long term, or at least in this first iteration.
Let's talk a little bit about the bigger picture. I mean, what's driving the Pentagon to take this new approach?
So what's interesting is China, I don't know if many people realize this, actually has more naval ships than the United States military does. Now, their ships aren't as advanced as the U.S., but in terms of mass, they have more. They're developing their own autonomous systems as well as a form of warfare. Those are two factors that are driving it, that if you can't the U.S. have as many ships, if it can't be ship-to-ship sort of warfare with the Chinese because they have more of them, are there other things that the U.S. can do to improve its warfighting capability? And part of it is a feeling that warfare is becoming more than just sort of ships and airplanes as we've seen them in the past, but really have to be married with more up-to-date technology, technology that isn't decades long, but something that can be updated and modified in a matter of months or years.
Right, so clear up a little bit maybe of that bureaucracy, get these new technologies to the military as quickly as they can. I guess that's the plan.
That's the plan. It's an ambitious one, and what I think is interesting about it is so often when we write about some weapon systems, it's usually years and years of following something. This one potentially is within this administration, whether they can sort of deliver it. And then longer term, can it survive changes in administrations or officials who decide maybe this isn't as necessary or want different types of autonomous or new systems?
That was our national security correspondent, Nancy Youssef. And that's it for Tech News Briefing. Today's show was produced by me, your host, Zoe Thomas, with supervising producer Melanie Roy. For more tech stories, check out the Wall Street Journal's website, WSJ.com. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.